Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. 4 years ago, the country was grappling with an economy and financial system that were collapsing. Our guest economist Mark Zandi says that President Obama, Congress, and the Federal Reserve deserve a lot of credit for taking steps that prevented another depression. We asked Mark Zandi to take us back to that scary time and to discuss what lies ahead as Congress and the White House face another challenge, what to do about cuts in military and domestic spending and tax increases that are scheduled to take effect on January 1st, unless they act. Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics, author of a new book called Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. And Mark Zandi joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. How would you describe this recovery?
Weak. Growth is about 2.5%. That's the growth in the value of all the goods and services that we produce. Job growth has been 150,000 per month, a couple million per year, and that's not enough to bring down unemployment in a significant way. So the unemployment rate is close to 8%, which is way too high. So I don't think there's any other way to characterize it but a weak recovery.
But it seems that some people have benefited in the last couple of years. It seems like the big banks are back, Wall Street is back, and it looks like the wealthy are doing pretty well.
Well, businesses in general are doing pretty well. If you look at profits, corporate profits, they're at record highs. Profit margins are as wide as they've ever been. Balance sheets for businesses, I'm generalizing, obviously, there are industries where you have problems like the newspaper industry, for example. But in aggregate, businesses are doing fabulously well. And you're right, higher income households have done well. They've weathered the storm better than anyone else. They've done pretty well throughout all of this. I wouldn't say they've been unscathed by this. They have homes that have fallen in value. They have stocks that are not worth less than they were at the peak. So they have felt this, but they've weathered the storm better.
We've talked about this before, but I'm going in the direction of the income disparity or income inequality in this country. And again, it looks like we have a country where some people do very well, and so many millions of people are struggling and even falling into poverty.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The Great Recession and the weak recovery have certainly exacerbated those trends. And they began all the way back to the early 1980s. And since the 1980s, the skewing of the distribution of income and wealth have become more pronounced. And it's due to broad, long-running trends, the globalization of the economy, which, you know, the opening up of trade and immigration and investment, I think, is a net positive for our economy, but clearly it creates winners and losers. The losers are the folks that have less skills and education. They're competing against low-wage labor and China, India, and other parts of the world, and so they've gotten hit hard. And then if you're educated and skilled, then you can sell essentially your talents to the rest of the world, and you benefit from that. So if you're an NBA basketball player or you work for a financial institution that sells its goods and services all over the world, you're benefiting from that. So there's other forces at work, but that's one of the key forces.
Even going back to 2008, and it is, frankly, quite shocking to relive some of those scary...
a lot of people don't remember how bad it was. It's amazing. I mean, if you talk to people, you get the sense that they've forgotten how scary it was. But it was truly a scary time, yes.
And because we were talking about the housing market collapsing, right?
Right. It was in free fall, right? House prices... had fallen between the peak in early 2006 to the early part of 2009. So that in three years, house prices had fallen almost 30%. And if you go back through our history, the last time that had happened was in the middle of, right into the Great Depression of the 1930s. The banking system was evaporating, literally evaporating. Huge institutions are no longer with us. Merrill Lynch is no longer with us. Countrywide Mortgage is no longer with us. Washington Mutual, these are, institutions that were staples of the financial system. They're gone. And even Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and a lot of other banks that are, survived, they came pretty close to going out as well.
Why did no one go to jail for what happened to the economy and the financial system?
Well, I don't know. I think it's the script still being written, but you're right. At the end of the day, I don't think many people will go to jail.
Do you think people should?
I don't know. What I do know is that there's a lot of blame to go around. And we all messed up in some way or another. Anyone in the financial system messed up. That's everyone from the banks to the rating agencies to the regulators to even to some households. I mean, when you get down to a lot of households were speculating in the housing market too, and you know, they made mistakes. So a lot of blame to go around. Mm-hmm. Does that mean you go to jail for that? If it's fraud, but you know, that's not necessarily, I don't think that's the thing mm-hmm. that. I don't think fraud is at the core of what went wrong. I think it was a systemic failure that had nothing to do with fraud.
Do you think if we had had, for instance, Dodd-Frank, and I realize it's still being written, the Volcker Rule, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, if those things had been in place, do you think we would have had the problems that we had?
That's a great question. So, of course, Dodd-Frank is the regulatory reform we got after the crisis that has created all kinds of controversy, and there are a lot of moving parts to it. I suspect that Dodd-Frank would not have forestalled a financial event, you know, because we did have a lot of speculation, and I don't think Dodd-Frank would have stopped the speculation that occurred in the housing market. But it may have prevented a complete financial collapse, because mm-hmm. the difference between a financial event and a collapse was the way we tried to solve the problems we had with these major financial institutions that they started to fail. You remember back, it was first Bear Stearns,
yes.
and then it was Lehman Brothers, and then it was Fannie Mae. Well, actually, it was Bear, then Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, then it was Lehman Brothers, and then this cascading effect. And the way government officials tried to address these failing financial institutions actually created more problems. And the problem they had was there was no cookbook here for them. They had no resolution authority, as they say, and they had no process for resolving these failing institutions. And so they were doing it on the fly. And that served to take this event, create panic, and cause the crash. So I think if we had Dodd-Frank now has that cookbook in place. How do you resolve troubled financial institutions? I think it would have made it less likely we had gone from this major financial event to this cataclysmic financial crisis.
Did we solve the too big to fail problem? Because I know some banks are bigger than they were four or five years ago.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the responses to the crisis was we had to resolve all these failing financial institutions, so they got rolled up together into these behemoth financial institutions, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citi, Bank of America, are now much larger than they were before. Dodd-Frank, though, does address too big to fail in that it does provide this framework for resolving financial institutions that are failing. And it also puts in different mechanisms for trying to ensure that these institutions are better prepared, that they have more financial cushion. So, for example, we have these stress tests that the banking system goes under now, where the banks have to perform experiments. What happens to me if the world goes very badly, if we get into another dark recession? And then in that environment, do I have enough financial cushion? Do I have enough capital? And do I have enough liquidity, enough cash laying around that I can manage through that? So these are, I think, good things, and I think they address the too big to fail concern. But, you know, frankly, Marty, I don't think we'll know until we get tested again, right?
And do you think we will get tested again?
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's going to be in our lifetimes, because this is so scarring. And I think the folks that are running these financial institutions, and more importantly, the regulators that are overseeing these institutions, they're going to make sure that this doesn't happen for a long, long time. But when my son takes over, he's going to say, my dad really didn't, I'm sure he didn't really know what he was talking about. He didn't know what he was doing. We have better data. We have better models. They'll make mistakes, and they'll have another financial event, and we'll get tested again. One other quick point about that.
Go ahead.
I don't think we want to design a financial system where we don't have financial events, because if we don't, that means we're not taking enough risk. And if you don't take enough risk, you're not going to do the innovation. You're not going to form companies that are going to create the Facebooks and the Googles. So you have to take a chance. You have to take a risk. And when you do that, you're going to make a mistake, and you're going to have financial events. So we don't want a system that doesn't allow for events. We want a system to ensure that those events don't turn into cataclysmic panics and crises.
Well, and if the risk is tied to innovation as opposed to just thinking like a casino.
Good point. Excellent point. We want to make sure that the financial system is taking our dear savings, what we save, and does something good with it as opposed to speculating with it. And hopefully Dodd-Frank helps in that regard as well.
There is some controversy, whether it's true or not, I'm not sure, which is why I'm asking you this question. Did the stimulus work?
In my mind, there's no controversy. It was a slam dunk success in that if we had not responded as aggressively as we did with the stimulus, and the stimulus encompasses a lot of things.
Right.
You know, a lot of people think of the stimulus as infrastructure spending, but that was a very small piece of it. There were a lot of other parts to it. But without the stimulus, I think the economy – and remember back, this was February of 2009 in the middle of this cataclysmic event when we were just pure panic.
Losing something like 700,000 jobs a month.
Yeah, actually in January of 2009 when President Obama was inaugurated for the first time, we lost over 800,000 jobs in 1 month, 800,000 jobs. So, you know, it was just complete free fall. Without the stimulus, then I don't think the economy would have found bottom, mm-hmm. certainly not as fast. And just to give you the timeline, the stimulus that we all refer to is the Recovery Act. That was the February 2009 legislation that was passed when President Obama got into office. And by the way, he was inaugurated mid-January. That was passed 3-4 weeks later. Mm-hmm. So it was done in a very rapid period of time. The recession, the Great Recession, ended in June of 2009, so just you know, a few months later, and job growth resumed in February 2010, 1 year later. I don't think there was any way we'd have gotten that kind of timeline if we had not responded aggressively with monetary policy, all the different things that government officials did, but perhaps most importantly, fiscal stimulus. And one other last point, the Recovery Act, that the main stimulus, if you look at the so-called spend out, when the tax cuts were occurring, when the spending was being done, you know, on unemployment insurance benefits, aid to state and local governments so they didn't have to lay off teachers, the infrastructure spending, all the things. That spend out, it peaked in June of 2009, the month that the Great Recession ended. So, you know, these are you could say, oh, there's all lots of other things going on, and yes, there are. But in my mind, that timeline is very strong evidence. It's not proof positive, but it's strong evidence that the stimulus was helpful.
Do you think the stimulus was big enough? And I realize that's maybe a more political question about what the Obama administration was able to get through Congress, but what was about $700 billion?
Yeah, it was almost $800 billion when it was said and done. No, it wasn't big enough, I don't think. I mean, I recall testifying at the time that we should make it bigger and that we should include a payroll tax holiday as part of the Recovery Act. Well, as you know, we subsequently did that. You know, we had a payroll tax holiday at the end of 2010. We extended it in the end of 2011. So we ultimately went down the path. But I think if we had put it up front, then we would have given enough of a boost to the economy that we would have gotten enough momentum in the economy to break free of the Great Recession. And I think ultimately the economic recovery, instead of being as weak as it has, would have been much stronger. You know, it wouldn't have been a great recovery regardless, but it would have been a better recovery.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Mark Zandi. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, author of a new book called Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. We are opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, managing severe orthopedic injury and joint disease. Their team of fellowship-trained and board-certified joint replacement surgeons, rheumatologists, and physical therapists are committed to using an advanced approach to joint care, individualized for each patient. Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, with locations in South Jersey and Newtown Square. More at cooperhealth.org/ortho or 800-8-COOPER.
Favorites have disappointed. Thankfully, we have an annual Sound Opinions holiday tradition, the Turkey Shoot. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. This week, it's our Thanksgiving Turkey Shoot. We aim at the year's biggest musical turkeys and take them out for good.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Forty years ago, the late Marvin Gaye composed the soundtrack for the film Trouble Man. Critics say it was some of his finest work. Now, a special edition of the Trouble Man soundtrack is being released, and we'll take a listen. That's next time on Tell Me More.
I didn't make it through the playing by the rules.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about the economy then and now and even into the future with economist Mark Zandi. And again, his new book is called Paying the Price. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mark, I know that you advised the Congress to bail out the auto industry.
I did.
Why?
Well, again, you have to remember the time. This was late 08, early 2009, and the auto industry was at death's door. GM and Chrysler were going to go into bankruptcy. And if they went into bankruptcy, because of the times, they would have been liquidated, meaning their operations would have completely shut down. And this would have thrown hundreds of thousands of people out of work. And then you'd had cascading effects. All the suppliers would fail. Dealerships would fail, and then strong auto companies would also probably fail. Ford, for example, would fail in all likelihood because their suppliers would have been out of business. So, you know, the number you hear was a million lost jobs. I don't know if it's exactly a million, but that's rough orders of magnitude. You'd lose another million, and this was in the context of losing 800,000 in a month. And this would be in the part of the country, the Midwest, that was just completely hemorrhaging. I mean, Michigan, that poor economy has been in recession since 2000. So losing jobs, unemployment, it would have been a complete mess. Now, some folks would argue, and I know Governor Romney did argue, that let him go into bankruptcy and the bankruptcy courts would iron it out. And in a normal time, that's absolutely the correct thing to do. But these weren't normal times, and GM, Chrysler would have gone into bankruptcy, and they would not get financing. No bank was lending. They weren't even lending to each other because they were at death's door. And so they would not lend to GM and Chrysler in bankruptcy and thus the liquidation. So you needed government help, and that's when the government stepped in. And actually, to President Bush's credit, he's the one who said we should use TARP money. Remember TARP, the bailout fund, to help provide financing to the automakers so that they can navigate through the bankruptcy process. And actually, at the end of the day, look what's happened here. I mean, it's worked out beautifully. GM and Chrysler, Ford are operating much better. Profitability is up. And they've been very important to the economic recovery. The recovery's been weak, but it would have been measurably weaker without them. They've been adding a boatload of jobs. And economies like Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, these are areas where auto is very important. These economies are doing better than many other parts of the country. So it was, I think, absolutely. There were mistakes, and we can talk about what those things are. And a broader point is, all of the policy responses to address the Great Recession had their flaws. I'm not arguing that they didn't have their problems, but at the end of the day, they were necessary and they succeeded.
Well, let me ask you about the unemployment rate. The official unemployment rate is 7.9%. Of course, that doesn't really tell the full picture of either who's working part-time or even looking for work or giving up looking for work. When you add all those factors in, what is our underemployment rate?
Yeah, good question. The underemployment rate is probably about 16%. So that would include the 8% unemployed. That would include part-time. These are folks that would like to work full-time but can only work part-time because they can't find a full-time job. And then our workers who have stepped out of the workforce because it's just not worthwhile to look for a job. They'll step back in at some point, hopefully when the economy improves and we get more job opportunities. But you add it all up, it's about 16%. So that's a lot of people.
Sure, it is.
And then, of course, everyone else is suffering, right, because you have such high levels of unemployment. Wage growth has been very weak. So if you look at total wage growth, it's only about a couple percent per year, which is no more than the rate of inflation. So people's so-called real wages, you know, their purchasing power is essentially going nowhere, and that reflects the very weak labor market.
Well, and isn't that also a sign that the economy is in not dire straits, but still struggling because we depend on people buying things in this country? What, 70% of the economy is based on consumer demand?
Yeah, that's right. You're absolutely right. The recovery has been weak. It's still struggling with a 7.9% unemployment rate of 16% underemployment rate. You can't be comfortable with this,
right?
Because in this kind of environment, if something goes wrong, and goodness knows there's a lot of things and we can talk about what those things might be, but if something else goes wrong, we're going to lose confidence. And confidence is incredibly fragile because of what we've been through. We'll all pull back and we'll be back in recession. And this time, there will be no policy response, right? I mean, we could respond 4 or 5 years ago because interest rates were higher and our deficits were lower and our debt load was lower. There was a political appetite to do it. There is none this go around. And so we We need much stronger growth. We need much lower unemployment fast so that if we do get hit by something, we can digest it.
But are we creating the kind of jobs that a developed economy needs? And by that, I mean either the kind of skill level, but also the kinds of jobs that, that pay a quote-unquote living wage.
Yeah, increasingly it's getting better. If you look at the job growth in the last year, it's increasingly broad-based across occupations, across industries. Low-paying occupations and industries like retailing and leisure, hospitality, and also some high-paying as well. We're starting to see job creation in manufacturing, going back to those auto jobs. Those are pretty good-paying jobs. We're starting to see some life in housing and construction. Those are pretty good-paying jobs. Professional services, so like management consulting, a lot of work I do, very high-paying. We're getting more accounting jobs, legal services jobs. These are, and, of course, healthcare. Healthcare employees people all along the occupational distribution. So I think it's not where we'd want to say it, but it is getting better, all the trend lines are improving.
You mentioned the word housing. I want to pick up on that. Then we'll get to our callers because, of course, housing, I guess, sort of like the auto industry, an important driver of the
even
U.S.
more important,
of
yes.
the U.S. economy. Yeah. And you're saying that there are signs of life. In
oh, yeah, industry. Absolutely. And housing, as you know, was ground zero for all of this, right? I mean, it was the speculation in the housing market, all the bad mortgage lending that occurred to finance the home purchases that blew up and took the financial system, caused these financial institutions to fail and fall to their knees. So it was housing that kind of drove all of this. And it's very positive and encouraging that housing has definitively turned the corner. So if you look at house prices, they've been rising since the beginning of the year. Nationwide, they're going to rise 5-6% this year. Home sales, that's housing demand, that's picked up quite significantly. We got another data point today. I haven't taken a look at it, but it should be a pretty good number. Housing construction, which is very important, obviously, to jobs, that too is starting to turn very low levels, but moving north, and all indications are that it will continue to move north. So housing has gone from being a significant headwind to the economy to now a tailwind, and that tailwind is going to start blowing very hard a year and two from now, and I think that's one reason to be optimistic about our near-term outlook.
Because if you're talking about building houses or selling houses, then you think about the companies that supply lumber or washing machines, those kinds of things.
Yes, think about it. You build a home, you have all kinds of stuff that goes into that, plumbing fixtures, steel, fabricated metals. Then you got people have to move that stuff around, transportation jobs, distribution, warehousing jobs. Then you have people who make the mortgages, the financial services jobs. Then you have the people who, do the cable hookup and the landscaping. And you think about all the jobs that are going to be created as housing improves. It's really quite significant. And that's really one reason why I think we're going to go from a couple million jobs a year, which is what we're creating today, to something closer to 3 million jobs a year, two years down the road. And that means that's enough job growth to bring down unemployment. So as long as the housing market continues to improve, and I think it will, our economy will improve.
And that's Mark Zandi, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a chief economist at Moody's Analytics. He's written a number of books, the most recent one, the newest one called Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. One of a number of economists that we've had on Radio Times to share some of their expertise with us.
Oh, you've had other economists, have you?
Oh, yes. You have to learn to share, Mark. Okay. You have to learn to share
Fair
the
enough.
Airwaves.
Yeah.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have, looks like, John from Lambertville joining us. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
And Mark for answering it. I just wanted to know what mechanisms were in place for some future event that might be speculative again that could raise an alarm. It just feels as if a lot of the people who were in place, reporters, analysts, during the crash are still in their same jobs. So how do we know we're going to get a warning sign in the future?
It's a good question,
yeah,
John.
Yeah,
it's
a very good question, John. Well, I'd say there's been a number of changes, but two key changes that would address this potential for speculation infecting our economy again. The first is we have, as part of Dodd-Frank, we've established an institution, the financial FSOC. Can't quite remember what the acronym stands for, but FSOC is a group of regulators that cut across all regulatory agencies that one of their key purposes is to monitor for bubbles, speculation, and to ensure that There are regulatory changes to address those developing bubbles and speculative factors that are affecting markets. Now, so we now have a formal group and process in place to try to monitor whether speculation or bubbles are developing. And I should say, for example, I get calls from the staff at FSOC asking, if I were them, what would I be looking out for? These are questions I never got,
know,
5 years ago.
Really?
So this is very encouraging. And I do know when they when I do bring up something, they will go look at it very thoroughly, and if they don't quite understand what's going on, they can continue to question. So I think that's a very therapeutic process. But perhaps more importantly, that the second thing is that we are now requiring our financial institutions to have more capital. They have to have a bigger financial cushion if things go wrong, and they have to go through that stress testing process that I mentioned earlier. So right now, for example, last Thursday, the Federal Reserve just released its economic scenarios for this coming year's stress test, and they're pretty dark scenarios. You know, what if things really went bad in China? What if the Eurozone cracked up? What if housing went down a whole nother level? You know, all these kinds of things, and they're asking the banks to go through a very quantitative, formal process of saying, what does this mean to me as a bank, to my loan losses, to my capital, to my profitability, and then to ensure that I have enough capital to withstand that kind of a scenario. So this is, again, something that we never did 5 years ago. The banks had no mechanism in place for doing this, but we now do have a formalized mechanism. And there are problems with it, but in general, I think that will be very helpful and guard against these bubbles developing.
I have to say, as an outsider looking at the system with a very rudimentary understanding of the system, it always looks like this game of cat and mouse between the regulators and those people that are trying to figure out how to, frankly, game the system for their benefit.
Well, yeah, in a sense, that's right. I mean, this is the financial institutions are a business. They are in the business to make money, and they're looking like any other business person to figure out how do I maximize my profitability given the constraints that I have. And of course, regulators need to watch the financial institution, and it's appropriate for them to do so because we backstop the institutions and we have deposit insurance, and so we have a right as taxpayers and to oversee and to regulate these institutions. But the regulators, that's exactly the way to think about it. It's a kind of a cat and a mouse game. I'm not sure that's a bad thing. You know, you want the regulators and the institutions to be pushing back and forth at each other because it's through that pushback and the give and take that we come up with a reasonably good solution.
But assuming that there is distance between the regulators and those that they regulate, that they're not all think of themselves on the same team.
Yeah, excellent point. And we have historically had this problem called the regulatory capture, where the institutions actually capture the regulators. I mean, a lot of the people who were in financial institutions go into regulation, and regulation come people work in regulatory bodies come into financial institutions. So you have to be very careful at doing that, guarding against that. But I'll have to say, at this point, if you talk to regulators or financial institutions, no one is, at least in the current environment, suggesting that's the problem. It's just the opposite.
Let me get, looks like Raj from Bryn Mawr to join us. And Raj, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning, Mark
good morning.
And Marty.
Good morning.
The question I have is, the rating agencies, from what I know, get funded by the companies they rate. And now that inherently sets up a way that's a conflict of interest. And I know in the light of what happened, they might change something, but it's so guaranteed that it'll go back to the way it was. What can you do to change that?
Raj, thanks for
Great point. And as you know, I'm an employee of Moody's Analytics. Moody's is an independent subsidiary of the Moody's Corporation, and I'm independent of the rating agency. So I'm not in the rating agency, just so that we're clear on that. You're right. There is an apparent conflict of interest, and I'd say two things about it. The first is that there are very strict rules and regulations and firewalls that try to mitigate this risk of conflict of interest, and they've actually been tightened in the context of Dodd-Frank. So it's not like no one's thinking about this. There are a lot of people are thinking about it and trying to mitigate this as a potential risk. But the second thing I'd say is I'm not sure there's a better solution, and that's the problem, because, you know, it's, you could argue, for example, well, let the investors pay the rating agencies, not the issuers of the bonds.
Right.
But you really want that? Do you want a hedge fund paying the rating agency for a rating? I'm not so sure that's a way to go. You know, there are other creative approaches, but no one's really kind of figured this one out in a good way. So that's why it doesn't seem to change, because no one can come up with a better model. Now, one thing that is important, the third thing I'll say, I said I was only going to say two, but I'll say a third thing, is that, yeah, that in Dodd-Frank, there is a, in some of the other regulatory changes, there is a move away from ratings. So historically, ratings were used in bank regulation, you know, how much capital should they hold and that kind of thing. Those ratings are being exorcised from the regulation, so the ratings will have less power in a sense. You know, historically, the regulators kind of outsource the regulation to the rating agencies. They're taking that function back, which is probably a good thing.
Raj, thanks for the call. Let's see what Mary from Berwyn has to say. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Well, I was going to ask if the Glass-Steagall bill had not been repealed during the Clinton administration, and it had been in effect since the bank failure in Roosevelt's administration, wouldn't we not have prevented this entire mess in the first place?
Mary, thanks for the call.
Yeah,
go ahead,
good
Mark.
Question. It's a matter of great debate. I don't know that it would have. No, you know, I think that in fact, in Dodd-Frank, you know, we have something called the Volcker Rule, which is an attempt to kind of go back, split up the commercial banking from the investment banking, and there's been a lot of controversy about how to do that. No, I think when you do that, you're not getting rid of the risk. You're not getting rid of the speculation. You're just putting it in a different place in the financial system. So all this risk would have been, instead of in these commercial banks, would have been, or in bigger financial institutions, would have been thrown out into the financial system somewhere else. And in all likelihood, a part of the financial system that had even less oversight, less regulatory, there would be less regulation. And so I'm not sure it would have made a big difference in that it would have made any difference. In fact, if you look at, you know, the real institutions that failed, you know, they weren't institutions that were deposit taking institutions, right? They were Lehman Brothers, right? Bear Stearns, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These weren't, you know, straight up commercial banks like J.P. Morgan. These, some of them got failed, like Washington Mutual and Wachovia failed, but that was, you know, after the panic hit and it just wiped out everything.
We're almost up in a break here, but does it also say that the way the banking industry in the 1930s is very different from what it is today?
Oh well, that goes without saying. Yeah, and you know, here's the other thing I'd point out to people, that it's different in one key way. It's very globally oriented. So our banks are not competing with each other. They're competing with BNP Paribas, you know, the Canadian banks, Australian banks, Bank of China, Itaú, which is the big Brazilian bank. And these banks are, you know, huge and can provide a lot of services to multinational corporations. So we need banks that can be able to compete on that level.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation again, talking with economist Mark Zandi. He's got a new book called Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. Just one or two open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be talking about the so-called fiscal cliff after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series supports WHYY, presented by Widener University, continuing its sold-out season at the Kimmel Center on November 26th with acclaimed reporter and National Geographic Explorer and Oprah Network host Lisa Ling. Sponsored by WHYY and BNY Mellon Wealth Management.
What does it mean to have a personal relationship with God? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tanya Lerman. She's a psychological anthropologist at Stanford University. Her book is called When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. It's now out in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. During Thanksgiving, many families talk about what they're grateful for. What if we turned the conversation toward how we actually give thanks? On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, the art and science of caring about others and the larger world. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
The
The Philadelphia Business Journal supports WHYY and is hosting the third annual Small Business Expo Delivering Happiness, December 11th at the PA Convention Center featuring Jen Lim of Zappos. PBJExpo.com or 215-238-5126.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. We're looking back over the Great Recession, as it is called, what led up to that Great Recession, talking about a number of policies that have been put in place to deal with some of the problems of the recession. And now I want to talk about the so-called fiscal cliff. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mark, is this really a cliff?
No. When people think of the cliff, what they think of is a Wile E. Coyote moment on January 1st, 2013, when the economy goes boom. No, it's not that. You've heard the words probably fiscal slope. It's more like a slope. And that slope is probably pretty modest, at least in the first few weeks of January, because what would happen likely is the Treasury would tell the IRS not to change our withholding schedules. So we wouldn't see those tax increases. And the Office of Management and Budget would probably tell government agencies not to change their spending, at least not quickly. The thinking would be that we're going to get a deal on this. So, you know, with each passing day that policymakers couldn't cut a deal, the pressure will mount. You know, equity invest, stock investors, and all of us will start to get nervous, and stock prices will fall, and credit spreads in the bond market will widen out. But, you know, it's not like on January 1st. My guess is that if the real drop dead date probably sometime in early February, if they haven't nailed it down by then, then we're going to have some big problems.
And just to be very specific here, we're talking about the potential of cuts in military and domestic spending.
Yeah, that's part of the cliff, those big cuts across the board, $1 trillion over 10 years, $500 billion on defense, $500 billion on non-defense. And that's on top of another trillion that we already agreed to back when we raised the debt ceiling in the summer of 2011. We agreed to $1 trillion in cuts. So it's a lot of cuts. Yeah, that's part of the cliff.
And also part of this are the tax increases, or I guess would be tax increases.
Yeah, we have big tax increases. So we all got tax cuts when President Bush took office back a decade ago. They all expire. So everybody's personal marginal tax rates would rise. We'd see higher capital gains, dividend income, estate tax. And of course, we have this 2% payroll tax holiday, meaning we're paying 2% less on our payroll taxes. And that expires at the end of the year. And so we get a tax increase there.
And the idea is to deal with the debt. I mean, the Congress, in a sense, put a gun to its head to try to deal with the debt.
Yeah, this is all by design. So they said, listen, we're not going to generate the political will to make these hard, tough decisions on tax policy and spending unless we do something like this. And they pushed it to the other side of the election. And that's appropriate because we needed an election to have this debate and discussion and see what the electorate said. And then we can decide. And because of the time pressure, we will generate the political will necessary to get this done. That's the thinking, and now we've got to execute on it.
Now, President Obama has said that he wants to let the tax cuts, I guess, expire for those making over $250,000. As an economist, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does in the context of addressing our long-term fiscal problems. I mean, we need tax revenue increases, which means probably you got to go where the money is. So that's high-income households, and that means if I were king for the day, I would allow those marginal rates on people who make over $250,000 to go back to where they were pre-Bush.
Which is what, 39.6%?
Yep, that's the top marginal tax rate.
Okay.
I would engage in some tax reform, meaning I'd probably cap the amount of deductions people could take.
That was a Romney idea.
It was a Romney idea, and I think it was a very good idea. If you cap it at, say, $50,000, meaning you can't take deductions worth more than $50,000, that would raise a fair amount of revenue as well, about almost as equal to the increase in the tax rates on upper-income households. But you need spending cuts, too. You know, we're not going to get back to fiscal stability unless we have those tax increases and big spending cuts. So we need to address entitlements as well.
But does any of this, let's assume that Congress and the White House come up with some kind of a plan to avoid this so-called fiscal cliff, does anything in that plan actually create a job?
It creates a job in the sense that, in this following sense, if we don't nail this down, if we don't come up with a credible plan, I don't think business people are going to engage. I think they're going to be very nervous about, you know, what are we going to do? Because they know this is a big problem. We're going to have to address it at some point. Either we do it together, collectively, and do it in a sane, reasonably sane way, or we're going to be pushed into it when investors stop buying our bonds and interest rates start to rise. Now, I don't know exactly when that will be, but that's the issue. No one does. And because no one knows when it will be, they're going to be very nervous and skittish and not invest and hire. So if we can nail this down, I think the confidence will improve. Let me put it this way. We're one piece of legislation away from a very, very good economy. And this piece of legislation is very doable. We can do it. It's not as hard as people think it is.
Talking about the people making over, I guess it's a household making over $250,000.
Yeah, household. On an individual basis would be $200,000.
Right. And that's after deduction. I mean, that's net. It's not gross. Well,
that's adjusted gross income. Yep. So you have to make over $250,000. Now, you know, just to give you context, we're talking about 2% of taxpayers, right? 2%.
So 98%
make less than that. Now, it varies a lot depending on where you live, right? If you live in the Northeast or you live on the West Coast, then a much higher proportion because cost of living is higher. So it would hurt this region of the country more than it would, say, Nebraska. But, you know, across the country, we're talking about 2% of the population.
The other group that's talked about when it comes to whether or not to increase taxes on those making more than $250,000 are small businesses. But again, doing a little bit of homework here, 97% of small businesses make less than $250,000. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you do. Actually, I think it's 97.45368. No, only joking. Yeah, sorry. That's exactly right. I don't think this is a big deal for most small businesses. And you look at the small businesses that are in that 3%, you know, they're a motley crew. Most of them aren't businesses, small businesses that you and I think of. It's not, you know, it's not the local
mom and pop.
No, it's not. I mean, a lot of them are proprietorships. They've been set up for investment vehicles. You know, these are, again, a lot of wealthy households have set these small, so-called small businesses up because of the way the tax code is structured. So, you know, I don't like raising tax rates on anybody. And if I were king for the day, I'd get all this revenue through tax reform. But, you know, I don't think that's likely or possible. And we have to remember, we have to put this into a political economy context. President Obama ran. The one thing he was incredibly specific about when he ran was, I want to raise this tax rate on upper-income individuals. So it was pretty clear here. And so I don't think there's any way that that's not going to happen in the context of the current political environment.
I do want to get back to our callers, but since you raised the question of tax reform, if you were king for a day, then how would you reform our tax system? And what is it, 17,000 pages or something of tax code?
I don't know. Yeah, is it 17,000?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds
like
right.
This on
yeah,
the radio,
it sounds right.
So several feet of tax regulations.
Well, I'm, there's a lot of different ways of doing it. I mentioned the cap. Say pick a 50,000, pick 45,000, pick 40,000, whatever it may be. You could cap one thing I wouldn't do is try to pick off individual credits and deductions in the code. So, for example, I wouldn't say let's scale back the mortgage interest deduction because if you do that, you're gonna have a constituency out there that are just gonna go to war over it, and we're not gonna get anything done. So what is, I think, the innovation here, and Governor Romney got this exactly right, and President Obama had a similar proposal back in his budget a year ago, is let's just cap these deductions and let the taxpayer choose which ones they want to keep. Do I want the mortgage interest deduction? Do I want the deduction for state and local income tax? What about property tax? What about charitable giving? You know, and it could be that people were going to take the charitable giving out of this cap. But I would argue you probably shouldn't. Everything should be in that cap and let taxpayers decide what they want to do with it.
The idea being that if I don't know if $50,000 worth of deductions, I don't know if that's – is that a lot of deductions? Is that a lot of
– No, that's big.
That's
big. It's only the very top income earners would be hit by that cap. Now, once you bring the cap in – if you made it 45 or 40 or 35, you know, you go down.
Sure.
Then it's going to affect more middle-income households. And this is where Governor Romney got in a little bit of trouble in the campaign because he didn't want to, you know, two reasons. One, he wanted a pretty low cap. And the second, he wasn't going to use any of the revenue generated by reform to address the deficit. It was, you know, all going to lower tax rates.
This might get us into the weeds, but why not treat all income the same? And mentioning Mitt Romney, as we learned his tax returns, he was paying something like 13 to 14% of his income paying taxes on a multi-million dollar income. Why not treat all income the same and then tax it all the same?
Yeah, well, that's partly the idea behind tax reform. We want to get closer to that ideal. Let's try to tax everything equally. You know, right now we got all these deductions and credits to try to get people to do certain things and give benefits to certain groups. Let's just try to get rid of that as best we can. But the other thing is, you know, things like capital gains and dividend income, you could argue that, you know, corporations, businesses, they pay tax on their income. And then they give a dividend or you get a capital gain. And therefore, you're double taxing that income, right? And so you're trying to equalize the total taxation of that income, and that makes it fair. It doesn't look fair when you look at just the personal tax code,
yes.
But when you look at the entire tax system, it is fairer in that way. That's why you don't want capital gains and dividend income, you know, at the exact same rate as personal income.
This may be showing my ignorance here, but don't a lot of us pay additional taxes? I mean, we pay our taxes, and then you go and you buy something at a drugstore, you're going to pay tax on that. Is that not double taxation?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, your sales tax,
yes.
Right? Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, but this is income earned by an entity, and you're saying, do I want to double tax that the income on that entity? And here's the other thing. You know, at the end of the day, we want a corporate tax system that is competitive, meaning we, again, are in a global environment. We need to be cognizant of who we're competing against. And if we're not careful about that, then we're going to lose jobs.
Mm. Let me get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Ken from Abington to join our conversation. And Ken, go ahead. You're on
Hello?
The air. Hi there. You're on the
yes,
air, Ken.
Hi.
Go ahead. Hi.
Yes. My question is about the emphasis, and it's a whole lot of emphasis being put on cutting the deficit in the midst of a severe downturn. That historically hasn't been a wise thing to do. I mean, many people theorize that depression went into a double dip and lingered a lot longer because they backed off the to kind of make sure that they didn't have more debt. So I wanted to have his opinion on that.
Ken, I appreciate the
question. Yeah, no, you make a great point. Excellent point. Obviously, the Europeans have botched this as well. They tried to impose a lot of fiscal austerity up front, and that clearly has not worked out for them, and they're backtracking. So when we think about what to do about the fiscal cliff, we should think about it in the context of the current economic environment. So we want to scale back that cliff so to a degree such that it's not going to be a problem for our economic recovery. But it's a balancing act because we also want to come up with a plan that's credible enough to convince everybody, including ourselves, that we are going to address our long-term fiscal problems. So we don't want to hurt ourselves in the near term. We don't want too much fiscal austerity in the near term, but we want enough fiscal austerity over, say, the next 10 years or longer so that we've convinced ourselves we got ourselves on a sound fiscal path. If we can do both those things, then we're golden. And then I think, you know, we're off and running. And, I think there's a reasonable probability that we're going to, coming out of this legislative process, this sausage-making process, we'll get something that's close to that.
But looking at our needs, infrastructure being one, and I think, Sandy, a huge reminder about the importance of infrastructure, and also education. If we need to get a much more educated, skilled workforce, we need to do a better job of investing in education, and we need a better roads, better bridges, better communication system.
Yeah, absolutely. Then that gets to the priorities with regard to what we spend on, right? Then we got to have this debate about, well, exactly what we're spending our money on and are we doing it appropriately. The other thing I'd say in regard to things like infrastructure, you know, there are ways to do this creatively where we bring in private capital, right? So there's this infrastructure bank idea, which you don't put all of the reliance on government to do the infrastructure spending. You bring in the pension fund money, insurance money, because they're very interested in investing, and you marry public money with private money, and you're going to get more infrastructure and probably better infrastructure, because when government's making a decision about should it be that road or that bridge or that dam, we probably make – it's driven a lot by politics, right? It's not driven by economics. Mm-hmm. And so if we have a private capital involved and we do this right, then that will be – we'll make decisions about infrastructure that are economically driven, not politically driven. So there's creative things we can do to make this work.
Let me get one more caller in. Looks like we have Liz from Philadelphia. Liz, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Liz.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I can't hear you very well.
I can hear you fine. Go ahead.
I wanted Mark Zandi to comment on Mark Krugman's suggestion that the national debt really doesn't matter because we print money, whether it's 20% or 25% of the gross domestic product.
Liz, thanks for the call. And I should add that Paul Krugman is one of the other economists we've had.
Oh, did you have him on?
Of
oh, yeah,
course,
okay.
Of course. Go ahead,
Mark. Well, I'm in good company then, because he's obviously a very, very bright man, and I respect his work very much. I think he overstates the case. I agree with him that we can't have too much fiscal austerity up front because the economy is weak and it would be counterproductive. But I don't agree with him that, I may be pushing his thinking too far, but sort of the way I would paraphrase it and the way you kind of paraphrase it is that we don't need to really be too worried about our long-term fiscal issues or our deficits and our debt load. I disagree with that. I do think that, a lot of my clients are business people, and if you talk to them, they can't come up with a narrative with respect to how we're going to address our long-term fiscal problems. And frankly, it is affecting their decision-making with regard to where should I invest, how much should I invest, should I hire, should I not hire. It's one of the reasons why the recovery is not engaging. And I think if we can come up with a credible long-term plan for establishing fiscal sustainability, tax revenue increases, spending cuts, then we're going to reestablish that confidence. And, I think business people will engage and the economy will improve. So, I sympathize with what he's saying, and I was very on board with him in the middle of the crisis that we have to be focused on, not on our deficits, but on getting the economy moving forward. But now is the time we have to start to pivot.
Liz, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Mark Zandi, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it as well. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, author of a new book called Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. And you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back. I don't know about you.